It is Friday, August the 19th. This is VOA's International Edition. Many thanks for joining us. Coming up, the Russian operation inside Syria.
The Syrian government sees Russian military support as enabling Syrian government forces to defeat and eliminate the Syrian opposition, or to make them so non-viable that at least the important parts of the country will succumb to Syrian government control.
Also ahead, future tensions in the South China Sea. U.S. Olympic swimmers disputed robbery claims, plus the BET Hip Hop Awards. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. The photograph of a bloodied young boy injured in an airstrike in the Syrian city of Aleppo has captured the attention of people around the world. It is circulated through traditional and social media channels. A physician in Aleppo identified the boy as 5-year-old Amran Dagnish. He confirmed the boy was taken to a hospital and treated for head wounds before being discharged. He was injured during an airstrike on a rebel-held territory, a part of the city there in Aleppo. Meantime, the United States has repeated this week that Russian airstrikes on targets in Syria from an airbase in Iran are not helpful in bringing the 5-year civil war to an end. U.S. State Department spokesman Mark Toner says it only makes worse an already very dangerous situation.
It's not helpful because, you know, it continues to complicate what is already a very dangerous situation in and around Aleppo when you have Russia using Iranian air bases as a way to carry out more intensive bombing runs that are hitting civilian populations. Our concerns remain very vivid, and we're trying to remain focused on, specifically with Aleppo, but on a broader scale, trying to get a cessation of hostilities back in place in Syria, and this doesn't help it.
Toner said the Russian air campaign in Syria, underway for nearly a year now, has largely been indiscriminate against civilian targets and moderate opposition groups, despite Moscow's claims of striking at terrorist groups like the Islamic State. Syria expert David Lesh of Trinity University told my colleague Victor Beatty there is no question that Russia and Iran are improving their tactical and strategic relationship, at least as far as Syria is concerned. He said one of the fears of critics of the Iran nuclear deal was that it would open the door to improved economic and security cooperation between Moscow and Tehran.
Whether or not this is long-term or just short-term with regard to Syria in reaction to the Syrian government experiencing some setbacks on the battlefield in Aleppo, that's perhaps another question. And to me, it seems like it's more of an attempt to make sure that Bashar al-Assad and the regime of Bashar al-Assad remains in power, because it is aligned, obviously, with Russian interests. This is something that Russia, ever since its initial military intervention in Syria a year ago, has made clear that they are committed to keeping this regime in power, which thus secures Russia's interests in Syria and in the heartland of the Middle East. And it seems with every sort of military setback that the Syrian regime experiences, the Russians attempt to bolster them again in order to improve the negotiating position of the Russia-Syria government side of the equation in any sort of negotiations, which are set to commence soon. The various sides of the conflict tend to want to improve their military position or to have a stronger hand at the negotiations. In my mind, it's more that rather than upsetting the whole strategic balance between U.S. and other parties.
David, the U.S. insists that these strikes are unhelpful to the aim of achieving a cessation of hostilities and also hindering humanitarian access to places like Aleppo.
It obviously is contrary to, you know, at least the spirit of a cessation of hostilities and certainly to humanitarian access. That doesn't mean the Russians don't want a negotiated solution. I'm convinced that they do, but they want a solution on their terms. I think they're very concerned about an open-ended military commitment in Syria. I think they've overestimated, and they realize this now, the capabilities of the Syrian government forces and pro-government forces, and realize that, you know, if there's to be a military victory, they'd really have to commit far beyond what they're willing to at this time. The problem in terms of any sort of negotiated solution is that, the Russians want to use their military in order to improve the negotiating position of the Syrian government and, again, bring about a political settlement more on their terms. And when I say on their terms, meaning that Bashar al-Assad will remain in power for at least through a transition and probably thereafter. The Syrian government, however, sees Russian military support as enabling Syrian government forces to defeat and eliminate the Syrian opposition, or to make them so non-viable that at least the important parts of the country will succumb to Syrian government control.
And as for Russia's emerging position in the Middle East, David Lesh said Moscow is the dominant outside power in Syria today, but it is a long way from being the top international player in the region. A senior U.S. official is calling for an immediate 48-hour pause, that is, in the fighting in Syria, so desperately needed humanitarian assistance can be delivered to the millions of people in Aleppo, as well as other besieged areas which have been without aid for a month. Lisa Schlein reporting now from the U.N. in Geneva.
The UN Special Envoy for Syria, Stefan de Mistura, abruptly suspended the regular weekly meeting of the International Syria Support Group's Humanitarian Access Task Force after 8 minutes.
I decided to use my privilege as chair to declare that there was no sense to have a humanitarian meeting today unless we got some action on the humanitarian side in Syria.
De Mistura noted the only action seen in Syria involves fighting, rockets, barrel bombing, chlorine and napalm attacks, suicide bombings, and other atrocities.
And in Syria, what we are hearing and seeing is only fighting, offensives, counteroffensives, rockets, barrel bombs, mortars, hellfire cannons, napalm, chlorine, snipers, airstrikes, suicide bombers. Not one single convoy in 1 month has reached any of the humanitarian besieged areas.
The one exception is the city of Deir ez-Zor, which is surrounded by Islamic State militants. De Mistura says the World Food Program has airdropped food supplies on 100 occasions to the 200,000 inhabitants of this area.
We ask for at least a pause of 48 hours. We insist on this in order to make anything meaningful for Aleppo. But the pause should also be accompanied by humanitarian aid, and that comes with it, and evacuation of medical cases.
De Mistura says he believes the United States and Russia, the two co-chairs of the humanitarian task force, are committed to finding a non-military solution to the Syrian conflict. But he admits he's concerned that this process is taking too long. He says more than 1 month has passed since U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry and his Russian counterpart Sergei Lavrov met in St. Petersburg to work out a cessation of hostilities. Unfortunately, he says, the hoped-for reduction of violence has not materialized. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And among the other stories we're staying on top of here on The Voice of America, South Sudan's former first vice president fleeing to neighboring Democratic Republic of Congo, and Twitter suspending 235,000 accounts linked to terrorism. You can get more on those stories plus the rest of the news at our website, voanews.com, and always on the VOA mobile app. Since the Permanent Court of Arbitration in The Hague ruled against China and its territorial claims to the majority of the South China Sea, Beijing hasn't altered its approach to that region. We get the story now from VOA's Steve Miller.
Chinese Defense Minister Chang Wanquan says the Chinese military, police, and people should prepare for mobilization to defend national sovereignty and territorial integrity. With Manila, Japan, the United States, and other members of the international community urging China to honor the court's ruling, what exactly is Beijing trying to achieve with its latest actions?
I think what they're trying to achieve is basically just to show their anger with the recent ruling that was in the Court of Arbitration in The Hague.
That's Harry Kazianis, Senior Fellow for Defense Policy at the Center for the National Interest.
And I think we have to break this down in terms of two sets of reactions. The first set of reactions is basically from what's happened from July and basically what's going to happen until early September.
Because that's when China is going to host the G20 summit. Kazianis says Beijing will continue pushing ahead using its current tactics to gradually change the status quo.
But they're not going to do anything that's highly escalatory or risky until after September.
China has telegraphed some possible actions, like land reclamation work on the Scarborough Shoal or declaring a South China Sea air defense identification zone. Greg Poling, director of the Asia Maritime Transparency Initiative at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, identifies 2014 as the year that China changed the way it was putting forward its claims. He says it was widely known that Beijing was bullying and coercing its neighbors, like Vietnam and the Philippines. But
in 2014, all of a sudden, we had Chinese artificial islands cropping up in the middle of the ocean, where previously there had only been submerged reefs. And that changed the balance of power in a really fundamental way.
Because China can now deploy military or law enforcement in numbers never seen before that far south.
Which, if it's not stopped, is going to allow Beijing to just saturate this area. And if the goal is to establish effective control in peacetime, it's just hard to see how the Vietnamese and the Filipinos and the Malaysians can continue to operate in any real way in the Nine Dash Line without China's forbearance.
Kazianis says rising powers have always challenged the established status quo.
So what happens next is really a history problem above all else. And how the United States and its allies will react to that, that's really the next key in this whole struggle for probably the next decade or so.
So what can be done to enforce the Hague ruling and prevent militarization of China's new outposts? Greg Poling again.
Ultimately, we have limited options. If China is absolutely committed to this strategy, no matter the diplomatic costs, then it's hard to see what the international community or those most involved, like the U.S. or Japan, can do. And that's an unsatisfactory answer if you're looking for how do we resolve the South China Sea tomorrow or next month or next year. But if you recognize that ultimately this is a 5 or 10 year contest of wills, then it's the only tool you have.
Steve Miller, VOA News, Washington.
And you can hear more of Steve's report on our website at voanews.com. All you have to do is click on the red tab, look for our broadcast programs, and then search for VOA Asia Weekly. This is VOA.
Democracy in action. That's what the U.S. presidential election is all about. Who's going to be the new president of the United States come November 8th? Tune in to VOA's coverage of the 2016 presidential election. Reports, expert analysis, and more. Professional, up-to-the-minute coverage that can't be found anywhere else. Right here on VOA.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. Brazilian authorities are saying U.S. swimmer Ryan Lochte and three other Olympic teammates were not robbed in Rio de Janeiro, where the summer games are underway, as they had claimed, but were detained after vandalizing a gas station restroom while they were intoxicated. Rio's police chief says the gold medal-winning Lochte and the others need to apologize for the robbery claims that embarrassed the Olympic host city. He said a video showed a security official pulling his weapon to restrain a drunk and angry Lochte and his teammates because they tried to leave after creating problems at the gas station. Lockheed had claimed a man posing as a police officer robbed him and his teammates as well while they were coming back from a party. For some perspective on all of this, VOA's Lori London asked Jonathan Bernstein, president of Bernstein Crisis Management, what would he advise Lotke if he were his client?
Well, the first thing I would say is the best way to put this behind you is to make a very humble, very transparent apology to the people of Rio and to his teammates and the Olympic Committee for turning what sounds like it was nothing more than youthful hijinks into an international incident. Because regardless of the facts as they eventually come out, it's pretty clear that the story, at a minimum, the story that he originally told is not true. And and that reflects very poorly on him and his teammates. And I was actually shocked to read one U.S. Olympic Committee spokesperson just wanted to write it off as useful hijinks and say, give him a break. But the fact is, athletes at that level are expected to set a higher standard. And he's let people down by the way he's responding now and appears to be hiding behind his lawyer for now, which makes him look more guilty, more defensive, instead of just coming right out and being humble and apologetic.
Yeah, I mean, he came home a hero, or he should have come home a hero, and now that may be in question as well. I mean, what about all the endorsements? What about his future?
Exactly. I mean, sponsoring athletes always has a risk associated with it because some athletes turn into bad boys or bad girls and reflect poorly on sponsors. So, sponsors look for athletes who have less chance of doing that. So I'm sure anybody who's offered him with sponsorships or already a sponsor has to be thinking twice about whether he could be an effective spokesperson or whether he's likely to go off the edge again and embarrass them. So this could have been completely avoided despite the initial behavior if he had much more quickly gotten on top of this. But as athlete after athlete has historically learned, the longer you delay in coming clean, the more damage you take. All you have to do is ask Lance Armstrong or Tiger Woods.
Is it too late?
No, it's never too late to reduce damage, because the longer this goes on, the more damage he takes. This should have been a one-day story, and obviously it's now morphing into a multi-day story, and what's really become the story now isn't what the incident was. The story now is the lie, and that's entire. That was entirely preventable.
And certainly not a good representation of someone there to represent the United States.
No, exactly. It is, once again, it's a higher level of character that's expected, and not just to demonstrate athletic prowess, but to demonstrate real class, like so many of our Olympians do and have done. But apparently not Mr. Lochte, and I guess some of his teammates at least initially went along with him, and now they're turning on him and cooperating with authorities. And that's, again, a predictable thing. And you can understand bad decisions made under the influence, but his decisions made since then have probably been made sober, and they've been bad ones.
That is crisis management expert Jonathan Bernstein speaking with my colleague, Lori London. When you look at the list of the more than 550 athletes representing the United States at the Rio Olympics, it's not hard to tell from some of the names that they or their parents might have come from another country. In fact, nearly 50 of them were born outside the U.S. VOA's Park Brewer spoke to an American freestyle wrestler who was born in Bulgaria and has his story.
The parents of Tervel Delagnev fled with him from Sofia, Bulgaria, when Tervel was only 3 years old.
The communist regime was falling, and the society at the time was not set up for anything else besides communism, so there was going to be a huge class shift. If you weren't really rich, you were going to be really poor. You know, it was kind of going to wipe out that middle class. And so the writing on the wall was, we were going to be a part of that, and we were just one of the lucky ones to be able to get out.
They made it to Austria by train, where they spent a year in a refugee camp. Even though he was so young at the time, Dolagnev still has vivid memories of the move, including the high-rise building surrounded by trees where they lived.
All the families from all the different countries would kind of just congregate in this, like, grassy area. And they all had, you know, all those kids would run around the building. All the doors were open. You'd go in and out of everyone's room. It was just kind of like one giant community.
Now that he's an adult at age 30 with a wife and two young sons of his own, Dolagnev often thinks back and wonders how stressful that must have been on his parents. After they got their documentation to come to America, they landed in San Diego, where his father joined the U.S. Army. Then he was transferred to El Paso, Texas, on the Mexican border. His parents told Tervell he needed to learn English quickly, but the bilingual classes were set up primarily for Spanish-speaking students. It was not until fifth grade when he was finally able to read a book. Dolagnev did not participate in competitive sports until his sophomore year of high school.
I was a big kid, so American football would have been a good choice, but in my household, it was a joke. It was like, that's not even a sport. American football is not a sport. I didn't have the build to be a soccer player.
Wanting to get in shape and lose weight, he decided to try wrestling. It all worked out. He became a two-time collegiate champion at a Division II school in Nebraska, and he's been on the U.S. wrestling team for 8 years. Rio is Dolagnev's second Olympics.
It's really fun. I mean, second time around, it feels fresh. I mean, obviously different venue, different teammates. It's really cool. So you just kind of try to take it in. You enjoy the experience. I think the first time around was here and over in an instant. And so this time I think I'm trying to slow things down and really enjoy it.
The 1.88-meter tall Dolagnev was disappointed with his fifth-place finish at the 2012 London Olympics. He's aiming for a podium finish at the 2016 Summer Games in the 125-kilogram class on Saturday. Park Brewer, VOA News, at the Rio Olympics.
And you can keep up to date on what's happening at the Rio Games on our website at voanews.com. This is VOA.
This is BizBeat.
The tropical beauty of Cambodia is unmistakable, and it's not a country known for high-end luxury resorts, at least until now.
Pourquoi ça la loge? C'est un endroit qui est merveilleux, en fait.
I love the feeling of being in a real village with fantastic customer service. Tetchin Farachi is one of the many tourists flocking to Cambodia, drawn by resorts like Sela Lodge, a traditional timber-designed five-star hotel. Another such site is made of thatch houses surrounded by rice fields and lemongrass, the Phum Bai Thong Resort in Siem Reap. Guest assistant Sotha Savanaroth can cart guests from luxury room to swim-up bar. She says we have lots of guests from Europe, but also Asia, Japan, and Korea. Yet another luxury resort in Cambodia is called Templation. 33 rooms, 21 private pools, and spectacular landscaping, catering to big-spending tourists who, according to the owner, are on the rise across the country. For VOA's BizBeat, I'm Philip Alexio.
This is VOA's International Edition. Thanks for joining us. Now it's time to see what's happening in the world of social media. International Edition's G. Abby Lee here with the latest. Hi, G.
Hi, Steve. Hashtag Trump Explains Movie Plots has been trending Thursday. The hashtag is used mainly by those who don't support Trump to mock his policy positions and style of speech. People who are using that hashtag is getting as many as 7,000 likes. Comedian Sean Dooley tweeted this. Big shark. Biggest shark you ever saw. I saw it, folks. Huge. Police chief. Great guy. Friend of mine. He killed it. I'm guessing it's referring to the Steven Spielberg movie Jaws, but I'm not sure. What do you think? Another person wrote this about the movie Titanic. A great ship. The best ship. Illegal immigrants steer it into an iceberg by Irish dancing.
You know, G, as I mentioned earlier in the program, there's this photo that was taken of a young Syrian boy. It's been trending. It was a big deal on Thursday, wasn't it?
Sure. The haunting image of a 5-year-old boy being pulled out of a rubble has been trending, raising awareness about the dire situation in Aleppo, Syria. He's identified as Amran Daknish, and a video of him being carried out from the rubble to the rescue vehicle was released by the Aleppo Media Center. As for the social media reaction, some people argue that the Obama administration's foreign policy is to blame for the exacerbating situation in the Middle East. Another popular opinion was pointing out the difference between what's going on in Rio and what's going on in Aleppo. While the Olympic Games is going on in Brazil, at the same time, there's a war going on in Syria where children are being sacrificed.
And of course, we've got to talk about the Olympics. What's the latest there on social media?
Absolutely. The probe against male U.S. swimmers in Rio is still underway. And the latest is that both Ryan Lochte and Jimmy Fagan may have been lying to the Brazilian authorities. A judge wrote in a filing that there were inconsistencies in the swimmers' testimonies. Steve, back to you.
Many thanks to you, G, our own social media guru, G. Abby Lee. By the way, you can follow G on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. I'm there as well at VOA Norman. And our program, International Edition, can be found on Twitter at VOA _IE. Now the world of music, where singer Drake is dominating the BET Hip Hop Awards for the third year, getting the most nominations with 14.
You used to call me on my cell phone, late night when you need my love. Call me on my cell phone, late night when you need my love. And I know when that hotline bling, that can only mean one thing. I know when that hotline bling, that can only mean one thing. Ever since I left the city, you.
BET is saying that Drake's song Hotline Bling is nominated for Album of the Year, Best Live Performer, and other awards to be presented in September in Atlanta. Drake's latest album, Views, has spent 12 weeks on top of the Billboard's 200 albums chart. Rapper, singer, producer Future, who released a collaborative album with Drake last year, is the second most nominated act with 10 nominations. Other nominees in the 18 categories include Jay-Z, Kendrick Lamar, Dr. Dre, Remy Ma, and Designer. 18-year-old Designer. How about that? Already getting nominations. Good for him. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on the Voice of America for International Edition. Good to have you with us. Latest world news is straight ahead. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Jimmy Cook, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Friday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
According to the State Department's annual International Religious Freedom Report, religiously motivated persecution continues to be perpetrated by governments and by violent extremist groups, such as Boko Haram and ISIL, also known as Daesh, around the world. The 2015 report, released last week, highlights in particular the worrisome prevalence of blasphemy and apostasy laws, which fully one quarter of the world's countries have on the books. Governments use these laws to tighten their regulatory grip on religious groups, particularly on minority religious groups and religions which are viewed as not traditional to that specific country. In his introduction to the report, Ambassador-at-Large for International Religious Freedom David Saperstein noted that the existence of these laws has been used by governments in too many cases to intimidate, repress religious minorities, and governments have too often failed to take appropriate steps to prevent societal violence sparked by accusations of blasphemy and apostasy. Ambassador Saperstein explains that even if accusations of blasphemy or apostasy turn out to be untrue, governments will often fail to act to hold the accusers accountable. The purpose of this annual report is not to lecture, but to shine a light on these problems and find ways to resolve them. The report also serves as an objective and comprehensive resource for NGOs, civil society groups, media, and foreign governments. The protection and promotion of religious freedom remains a key foreign policy priority for the United States. As daunting as the many challenges are that we face across the globe, we will not be deterred in the work that we do, said Ambassador Saperstein. This report is at once vivid testimony for the many whose plight might otherwise receive scant attention, and a document, a blueprint of what must be addressed to bring us closer to the day when religious freedom will thrive for all. Ambassador Saperstein added that U.S. government officials, including at the highest level, speak out regularly against abuses and violations of religious freedom and raise these concerns directly with governments that fail to protect religious freedom.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.